We don't often talk about novels on The Exchange, but we could not pass up the chance to talk about two at the same time. The authors have come to know each other over time and about their families. It's this simple. Rachel Kadish's grandparents were survivors of the World War II Nazi Holocaust in Poland. Jessica Shattuck's grandparents were members of the Nazi Party. They both got recent books out. Jessica Shattuck is the author of The Women in the Castle. Rachel Kadish wrote The Weight of Ink. They are both historical novels, though dealing with different periods in history. Rachel Kadish has a pair of previous novels to her credit, From a Sealed Room and Tolstoy Lied, a love story. She lives near Boston and teaches in the MFA program in creative writing at Lesley University. Jessica Shattuck lives in the Boston area as well and also has published a pair of previous novels, Perfect Life and The Hazards of Good Breeding. Welcome, Jessica Shattuck.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome, Rachel Kadish.
Thank you so much.
So given where you live, it's not surprising that your paths crossed. Rachel, can you tell us how and where?
Sure. A couple of years ago, we became members of the same writing group, and it's a bunch of writers, six of us, and we meet about once a month to talk about specific pieces we're working on and to talk about issues that come up in the publishing world and all of that. And Jessica and I did not know each other before that, but at a certain point, you know, she made some comments about a part of her family coming from Germany. But then several months ago, she published a piece about the fact that her grandmother had been a member of the Nazi Party. And I approached her at that point and I said, let's talk about this, because she knew that my family were Holocaust survivors. And I thought, this is going to be an interesting conversation. And it felt important to have the conversation. And it was, once we started talking, we sort of couldn't stop.
Jessica, was that your New York Times op-ed? I loved my grandmother, but she was a Nazi.
Yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh. I have it in front of me here. So, you hadn't talked about that with Rachel before it was published?
We hadn't. I mean, we had talked about we'd kind of skirted the issue, I think, as people do. Rachel was aware that I was working on a book that in some ways was inspired by parts of my family story, and that the book was set in World War II and post-World War II Germany. And I knew that she was the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors from work of hers, an essay of hers that I had read. And so we knew we kind of had an interest in that time period and trying to understand it, and I feel like that had come up in a few places. But I really appreciated when Rachel approached me and said, let's talk about this specifically. Let's not, you know, it was a very direct idea. And then, as she said, we met at a coffee shop and got going on this, and I felt like we both just had, it was like a faucet. We both had so much to say.
Were you apprehensive, Jessica, then, about bringing up the subject directly with Rachel?
I think I've worked through some of that in the process of publishing, first of all, writing this book and then publishing it, and the book deals a lot with, it's the three widows of members of the resistance, but they turn out not to all have actually been members of the resistance, and one of the characters is a kind of analog of someone like my grandmother, who is initially enthusiastic about Hitler and all that he seems to promise to Germany. So this is a conversation that I've started to get used to having, but certainly for years, this was not something I ever talked about. I mean, I grew up not even wanting my mother to pick me up from school because other kids would hear her accent and the fact that she was from Germany was going to come up. And I didn't want to have to talk about that. I was embarrassed about the fact that I had grandparents who still lived there. And occasionally someone would say, you know, whoa, what did your grandfather do in the war? And that was kind of the question I dreaded. Like, yes, he fought in the war. He was on the German side. Ugh. So it was something that it took me until literally the last 7 years, and I'm 43 now. I'm 45.
43 when this process started, though.
Yeah, the process started. Well, this book took me over 7 years to write, but during that time, I kind of became more able to own this conversation, I guess, and talk about it and not have it be under the carpet.
So had you always known, about the Nazi part of that? I mean, you know, it sounds like it's something you had for a long time.
Yeah, no one was ever hiding anything from me. My mother came to America when she was 19 and never moved back to Germany, and that was partly because of her disgust and anger with the country of her birth and with her own parents. So she raised me with a lot of awareness about Germany's responsibility in the war and about the Holocaust. So it wasn't as though there was one revelatory moment where I learned, oh my God, my grandparents were members of the Nazi Party. But it did take a while for that information to, for kind of a finer point to get put on that. It was always sort of general, and I hadn't spoken in very specific ways about it with them. And then after my mother passed away when I was a teenager, I actually spent a summer talking with my grandmother about my mother's childhood, but then that led to, my mother grew up after the war in Germany, it led to talking about the war itself, and that led to ultimately learning more about what they had done and how they had been enamored of the idea of getting Germany back up on its feet and everything that Hitler promised in the beginning. So that's sort of a long answer to that, but it was a process of learning that fact.
And then, Rachel Kadish, as you were growing up, how much did you know about your grandparents, the ones who had survived the Holocaust from Poland?
I grew up very steeped in their stories. It's interesting. I think in some families with Holocaust survivors, you have people who, you have survivors who did not speak at all, and you have survivors who couldn't stop speaking about it, understandably. And I think my grandfather was in the middle, but more toward, he would speak a lot. And I knew all kinds of crazy stories. My family, they were on the run, were in Poland, Hitler did, and they were on the run for a couple of years. And they, you know, the crazy stories would pop up. They had, you know, that was the night we couldn't find any safe place to sleep, so we found an underwear and we slept in coffins. Or, you know, just stories about them captured, sneaking across the border and being Russian. My 93-year-old great aunt still says, "Yes, I'm a jailbird because the time in prison."
Wow. Okay. All kinds of interesting stories to get into here from your grandparents. Jessica Shattuck's grandparents were members of the Nazi Party. Rachel Kadish's grandparents survived the Holocaust in Poland, and they've both written books. Not directly about, well, actually, I should point that Jessica Shattuck's book is about post-World War II and the years leading up to it, called The Women in the Castle. And Rachel Kadish's book is called The Weight of Ink, which moves back and forth between 21st century discoveries, but of things that happened in the 17th century. We'll get into the specifics of the books when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be welcome to take your phone calls and emails as well when we return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking to two novelists about their two novels and something like a shared heritage between them. Rachel Kadish is the author of a book called The Weight of Ink, recently out. Jessica Shattuck is the author of The Women in the Castle. And they discovered over time that that Jessica's grandparents were members of the Nazi Party in Germany during World War II, grandparents, and Rachel Kadish's grandparents were Holocaust survivors of the Nazi Holocaust in World War II. And they've been working together to get their shared story out, and in addition to talking about their books, which we'll do in a moment. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's get into your books. The Women in the Castle first, set at the end of World War II in a beat-up castle in Bavaria. Who are the three main women here we're talking about, Jessica?
The three main characters are widows of resistors who were executed for their roles in the failed attempt to assassinate Hitler on the 20th of July, 1944. And as many of your listeners, I'm sure, know, that was a real event and a real attempt, and there were many executions that followed it.
On this date in 1944, I want to be clear on that, yeah.
Yeah, my characters are fictional, so I sort of created them and shoehorned them into the plot that is real, and all of the facts and circumstances around it are real, but I wanted to have characters who I could mold and sort of create my own plot around. So these women are trying to put one foot in front of the other and raise their children and make ends meet and just kind of get through the kind of devastation of that time after the war. It begins in June 1945, and it ends up in the present day, but it is primarily set in those initial 5 years after the war, and it flashes back somewhat into the war, too. And each of these women is sort of hiding some secrets and different histories that don't at first present themselves.
I love what the New York Times said. This is definitely not a story of plucky women banding together to fix up a chilly home.
Right. No.
But so this is a situation where these people have secrets to keep for themselves and also from each other up to a point. So and I wonder from your own experience with your own family how much of that was a condition of post-war Germany.
I think it's a big condition of life in post-war Germany. Some secrets are kept more actively than others. I think I talk to so many people of my generation who have grandparents like my own, and I've heard from so many people, oh, we never talked about the war. Oh, that's right. I know my opa fought on the Western Front, but he never mentioned it. And then I'll say, but did you ever ask him about it? And usually people will kind of be taken aback, like, well, no, I never asked, because it was clear that nobody wanted to talk about it. So I felt that way myself for a long time, and certainly with my grandfather. My grandmother I had many conversations with, and she proved to be really open to and really, really wanted to talk about her experience. But even my grandfather was a very formidable figure who I wish I had pressed more on many points, so I can relate to that sense. But anyway, as far as secrets go, I think that sometimes secrets are complicated, right? They are. It kind of takes both the secret keeper and the people who it's being kept from to facilitate a certain history being kept secret. But I think that for many people, it was just such a painful time, and there are people of my generation who just want to keep moving forward, and there are certainly people of the generation who lived through that time who were both, you know, unsure of how to talk about it, unsure of how they would be judged, and probably if they were, I mean, I think everyone falls in different places on this, but people like my grandmother judged herself, and I think that the rest of her life was spent with a kind of reckoning with how she had managed to be complicit in a movement that became synonymous with evil, and I think that that is something that many members of that generation kind of kept under their hats.
But the choice of term, complicit, and I wonder, was she more passive? I mean, was it just the kind of thing you did, I mean, to make sure that you kept your place in society in Germany during the war, you joined the Nazi Party? Or was it a little more supportive than that?
I think it's very, I mean, obviously it spans the gamut, and that the people that I'm the most interested in looking at and that I tried to focus my novel on were the people who exist in that sort of middle gray zone between serious Nazi leaders or people intimately acquainted with the evils of the concentration camps, like concentration camp guards and stuff, and on the other end, resistors and victims. That's a huge space in between that, and there certainly were people who were just going along and joining the party because it was expedient to do so, but never believed in it. But then there were many people like my grandmother who really did believe in it in the beginning. And I never knew her to be, in her description of it to me, she was never enamored of the anti-Semitism or the racism. It wasn't those elements of it that drew her in. It was the promise of this huge infrastructure project that Hitler put into place. It was getting everyone back to work. It was her own work leading young people in the countryside, teaching them agricultural skills under this kind of Hitler Youth sort of agricultural program umbrella. So, you know, she owned that, and I have trouble, you know, obviously I didn't know her at that time, and I think that some of the hateful rhetoric and elements of Nazism were very commonplace. It was sort of a baseline of society, was that it was okay to make big judgments on racial and religious grounds. Maybe even here in America as well as in Europe, although I think it was worse in Europe. Anyway, so I think that that she would own that she had been swept up in some of the other elements, and she had sort of turned a blind eye to those darker sides, which turned out to, of course, be what defined that whole time. And that was, she would say herself, her great mistake was not really listening.
Jessica Shattuck, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her grandparents were members of the Nazi Party. She's the author of a book called The Women in the Castle. We also have with us Rachel Kadish, who is the author of the book The Weight of Ink. And her grandparents were survivors of the Nazi Holocaust in Poland. And Rachel, you go a bit further back in time in the story of The Weight of Ink. How far back did you go?
Well, I go back to the 17th century, but the story is also contemporary, so it weaves back and forth. The novel starts when 17th century documents are discovered now in London, contemporary London, when a 17th century house is being renovated. And the documents are in Hebrew and in Portuguese. And so at the opening of the book, a British professor of history is called in, a woman named Helen Watt, and she's a non-Jewish English woman with a very personal reason for her passion for Jewish history. And as she starts studying the documents, and looking into, they at first blush, they seem to be written by a 17th century rabbi in the small hidden Jewish community of London, but then it gets more complicated, and it emerges that they were actually written by a woman scribe, which was very unusual, and a very determined 17th century woman who mounted an elaborate deception in order to live the life of a mind. So you have a contemporary story interacting with the 17th century, but I think the way this connects to this whole history for me is that why does this British professor have a personal connection to Jewish history? It's because of a long-ago love affair with a Jewish Holocaust survivor when she was younger that has haunted her. And those stories, they come into everything I write because that's what I grew up with among these Holocaust refugees. And then I think also what fascinated me about the 17th century Jewish community, this tiny hidden Jewish community in London, was that these were Inquisition refugees from Spain and Portugal. And there was something about reading about these Inquisition refugees 300 and 350 years ago that was so familiar to me because I grew up among Holocaust refugees, and just thinking about what it means to have that total displacement and that fear.
Wow, that is an amazing parallel. I hadn't quite considered on that level before. But, I mean, the Spanish Inquisition was the Catholic Church really attempting to assert its authority over all aspects of society. In a way similar to what happened in Nazi Germany. Helen Watt, the historian, is not in great shape as the book begins. What's up with her?
She has what's later revealed to be Parkinson's. She has a severe hand tremor, and so she shouldn't be handling delicate documents, 17th century documents, although she does break that rule sometimes. But she brings in a very talented and very arrogant postgraduate to help her and also to handle the documents physically for her, and that's a young American Jewish student, Aaron Levy. And the tension between the two of them is a big part of the book, and also the question of who does this history belong to? Does Jewish history belong only to Jews? Does it belong to non-Jews? Does everybody's history belong to everybody? So that's in there.
And Aaron's observation about Helen is pretty telling, that, well, okay, I guess I'm dealing with a person with no sense of humor here.
Yes. Well, you know what? I really like writing about difficult characters because, first of all, they're a lot more, much more fun on the page than sometimes dealing with people like that in real life. But every time I start thinking about a really difficult person, inevitably, when I start writing about them, they sort of crack open, and then you see what's going on inside them, and then I absolutely fall in love with these characters. So I had fun. And, of course, when you have two characters who start out hating each other like that, that's great fun because they have to work together. So that's fun on the page.
So on a one-to-one scale, you can kind of crack people open and get an idea of motivations. On a larger scale, though, like to deal with people like the Nazis or the Spanish Inquisition, is it just that much harder to try to find motivations that make any sense?
Well, this is something that I think is actually really important. I think we have to figure out motivations, and we have to try to understand people, and forgive me if I get up on a soapbox a little bit here, but understanding someone is not the same as forgiving them. I think that's really important. I think a lot of people are afraid to say, afraid to look at the human side of somebody who might have joined the Nazi Party or somebody who might have done something awful, because that might mean we're condoning them. It doesn't mean that we're condoning the actions. What it means is we're trying to understand them as real human beings. And the reason I think that's so important is if we act like the Nazis or, you know, people who participate or even are bystanders to atrocities, if we act like they're from another planet, it's called planet evil, they're nothing like us, we don't have to worry, we're safe over here, we're the good people who could never do anything like that, we learn nothing useful. And we need to learn the useful lessons if we want to prevent things like this from happening again. What we need to understand is where are the cracks inside all of us where a hateful ideology could appeal to us because it also made us feel good about something else or gave us something else we needed. That's why we need to understand people as real people. And so, you know, I think both Jessica and I have talked about not wanting to write about the people who actually do the worst things, but what's fascinating is looking at the people who were bystanders or who turned a blind eye to certain things. And to go back to a question you asked earlier, you were asking Jessica if she was apprehensive about our conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I hadn't thought to ask Jessica that, but I remember walking into that coffee shop thinking, I really hope Jessica will trust me. I hope she'll understand that I get that, of course, she loved her grandparents. I would never ask anybody not to love their family members. Because we love our family, and it's okay. It's okay that, you know, I'm not going to say you have to have no love or utter condemnation for people who are in your life who are on the edges of this.
Two guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Rachel Kadish is the author of the book The Weight of Ink, which deals with people in the 21st century discovering the work of people in the 17th century, a Portuguese scribe working for a rabbi in a hidden Jewish community in London. Jessica Shattuck is the author of The Women in the Castle, which is about women living together in the days after World War II. Thinking they're all people who were members of the resistance, or that they're, but finding very different stories about each other along the way. You can join the discussion as we get further into the stories of the characters in the book, and of course, our real life people, because Jessica's grandparents were members of the Nazi Party. Rachel's grandparents survived the Nazi Holocaust. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
This is an endlessly fascinating and, I think, relevant subject. There are two things that I would like to address. One is the issue of complicity, which isn't just the silent majority, the people who wanted to make Germany great again, as the saying goes, right? Just made that up.
All right.
But it's also the Jewish victims. And this is my family, a part of it, and I'll get to that in a second. They actually embraced the post-World War I, let's make Germany great again, objective. They were, my grandfather, who died in a concentration camp, was a World War I veteran, decorated, and he believed in the objective of a prospering Germany. I mean, it's sort of since the Jews were part of the successful classes, right? Mm-hmm. They embraced that hope for success, right? So there is, where do you define complicity? I mean, where do you draw the line? And complicity doesn't mean guilt necessarily, but where does it? The second part is sort of almost a curiosity. The one grandfather of mine, and I really didn't know either one of them, died in Theresienstadt. My grandmother was in Theresienstadt. My other grandfather, and I only found that out late, this relates to the not talking about stuff, right? Mm-hmm. He was the commander of Stalag 7A. Which the POW camp in Moosburg, at the largest POW camp, and he, with his heroic actions, which was defying Nazi rules and all of that, he saved the lives of about 80,000 American POWs because he commandeered trainloads of food for what he called his people, right?
Uh-huh.
So the extremes are amazing. You know, you can't have any more extremes, really, than in my past.
No.
How does it affect me? You know, you just have to look at everything.
All right. I appreciate the sharing of the story there, Wolfgang, very much. And I wonder how much this resonates with you, Jessica, given the, what you know about what your family activities were during the war.
Yeah, thank you for that call and for sharing that fascinating history. That is really remarkable to have those two figures in your family. I think what this caller was raising the question of is a really good one, which is how do you define complicity? Where does it begin? Where do you, and how does it distinguish from enabling? I mean, these are words I'm using a lot when I'm talking about my own family history and when I'm talking about my book, people being enablers, people being complicit. There's sort of a level of, it's like a stairway in some ways, right? To me, complicity comes in when you actually start to be aware of some of the evil undercurrents, or let's not use such a dramatic word, not evil, some of the destructive undercurrents of something that you've embraced, and you choose to turn the other way. To me, that's kind of where I start thinking someone is complicit. But again, that's a slippery, it's hard to know, well, when do people really, we can tell ourselves so many stories, and we can misguide ourselves that we can look something in the face and not recognize it when it's right in front of us. I think of a quote that I love of a resistor who talked about being a young soldier who came up in front of his battalion was deployed to see to be a part of this killing in a small town in Poland, and he was late and he arrived, and he described it that he saw what was happening, but even as he was looking at it, he couldn't wrap his brain around it. He couldn't even imagine that what he was seeing was what was really happening. So that kind of thing contributes to that.
Absolutely. Confusion. So, yeah, and it's not so much being passive as just not quite getting your brain around it. We'll come back and pick up the discussion on the other side of a break with Jessica Shattuck and Rachel Kadish, both novelists with some history behind themselves. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I want to thank you for listening. We are taking an interesting tack with a couple of novelists today on the Jefferson Exchange. By coincidence, this date, July 20th, is an anniversary of the attempt to end Hitler's life by some people who are fairly close to him during World War II. It is a story of resistance people who wanted to get Germany back on a right path that leads to the story of The Women in the Castle, a book by Jessica Shattuck, a novel about women whose husbands were killed for their participation in that plot, coming together in a beat-up castle in Bavaria after World War II. Jessica Shattuck actually has known for many years that her grandparents were members of the Nazi Party in Germany during the war. On another avenue, we have Rachel Kadish, who wrote a book called The Weight of Ink, which oscillates between discoverers, historical researchers in the 21st century in London, and Jews living in London in the 17th century. In her book, The Weight of Ink, and her grandparents were survivors of the Nazi Holocaust in Poland. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Rachel, I want to come back to some of the subject matter in your book, The Weight of Ink, because we haven't talked that much about Aaron Levy, who's the assistant to Helen Watts, the historian in modern-day London, researching these documents found from the 17th century in London. What is his primary research about before he meets Helen?
He is trying to suss out what connections William Shakespeare might have had to the Jewish community, a very small Jewish community in London at the time. You know, at that time, many people don't know this, there were several hundred years where Jews were officially not allowed in England. They had been kicked out during the Crusades, and they were only tentatively readmitted under Oliver Cromwell. But there was a small Jewish community, and several people have tried to ask the question of what the connections might have been between Shakespeare and that community. And Aaron is trying to find some new evidence of connections, and he's failing miserably when that novel opens.
Does Shakespeare's creation of Shylock tell us much about what people thought about Jews in England at Shakespeare's time?
Yes, I think so. And then, of course, since evidence in the last decade or so has emerged about Catholic roots in Shakespeare's family, then the question also comes up, was he writing directly about Jews only, or was he also writing indirectly about what it meant to be a religious minority in England, which, of course, kept during those years kept flipping back and forth Catholic, Protestant. And I've seen very, very different reads of Shylock on stage.
Mm-hmm. So I want to bring up the figure of Helen Velasquez, because we haven't mentioned her by name yet. She is the scribe for this blind rabbi in the 17th century. How unusual was it for someone to take that role at that time?
Yes, Esther Velasquez is a scribe for this blind rabbi,
yeah.
And it's no problem. And it's super unusual because women, although the Inquisition refugee community took pride in educating its daughters, still women were not given access to books and learning that way. But the only reason that she is that she is in this tiny community in London, and there's this blind rabbi who needs a scribe, and they're just aren't other people with the education required to do that. So she ends up scribing for him, and at first just transcribing what he's writing, but then at a certain point realizing that she can start writing what she wants to write, which was very forbidden, and she wants to be in this philosophical conversation going on at the time. And this is a time in Europe where people were literally ripped limb from limb for questioning religious authority, for discussing atheism, but that's the conversation she wants to be in.
All right, so definitely we have people who are doing things quietly because they have secrets to hold in both of these books, The Weight of Ink and The Women in the Castle. I should point out, Jessica, that the opening scene in Women in the Castle is a harvest party at the castle before the war, which turns out to be on the night of Kristallnacht. And I wonder, in your research, whether you were able to come to your own conclusions about what the division in German society was about the activities of that night when so many Jewish businesses were targeted for destruction and fires and the broken glass that leads to the name Kristallnacht.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for that was obviously a huge turning point for in the world's understanding of what was going on with Hitler and in Germany's own understanding, because there were many people who were shocked and horrified to hear that this had happened, and even people who had previously maybe felt that there was some promise to this leader who was, offering all these jobs and seemed to be getting Germany up back on its feet after years of sort of being down and out after World War I. And then there were other people who I'm sure were. I think that there were plenty of participants and. Many of the people, who were involved in it were in the SA, and that was kind of a thuggish, Hitler's sort of thuggish right arm, which I think I think the general consensus is that in some ways he realized he'd gone a little far for the appetite of what the public could handle at that time. And it was the beginning of the end of the SA when Hitler sort of realized, oh, this is not giving me, this is actually putting a bad name on what I'm doing. So he stepped it back a little in a kind of sinister and pragmatic way.
There's a quote in this part of the book that could easily be lifted and applied to many, many leaders throughout history, I think. It's a leader whose lowbrow appeal to people's most selfish, self-pitying emotions and ignorance was an embarrassment for their country. And Rachel talked about not wanting to get up on a soapbox a few minutes ago. Are you speaking about anybody other than Hitler here?
I think that there are a lot of parallels people are making today, and certainly this book was, I had finished it and put it to bed before the election even occurred, so any connections are certainly not explicit, but I see the parallels, and I do think that there is something very appealing at any time, but especially at a complicated time like today and like the 1930s in Germany. People can get swept up enthralled by a leader who's promising really simple solutions and simple answers to really complicated problems. I see that parallel.
Rachel, you talked about this before, too, about the way that people might have said, well, I'm not crazy about the way that certain minorities get treated or something along those lines, but, I like this program. And I think Jessica mentioned specifically that her grandmother was okay with the infrastructure project that Hitler was proposing. I mean, it seems like people are willing to take a lot of bad things when they think there's a good result at the end.
Right. And that's an enormously slippery slope. And I think, you know, we all need to look very carefully at what we're part of or what we tolerate. And I think another piece of the conversation that Jessica and I have had is about this feeling of powerlessness that we can all have sometimes in the middle of intense political national situations. And I think one thing that I feel very strongly from growing up with my family's history is there is nothing more powerful than the individual. There is nothing more powerful than one person saying, hey, wait a second, this isn't okay with me. And I say that, and what I always come back to is this. If you look at any person who survived the Holocaust, you know, or being on the run or something like that, you think to hide one person for a year in a barn, let's say somewhere in the countryside, you needed 30, 40, 50 people to all do the right thing, because it's not just the farmer who was hiding that person. It's the person in the village who noticed that some extra medicine was being brought to the barn and just didn't say anything. It's the person who positioned their body just to block an officer from having a direct line of view of something. You need all these people just to do the right thing in order to save one person, whereas to betray one person, it took just one other person saying, hey, go over there, there's someone in the barn. So there's nothing more powerful than each of us individually making our choices. And I think that there's a danger to passivity. There's a danger of, you know, I'm just one person, and, okay, I'm part of this thing, and it has some unsavory elements, this political party or whatever, but you know, I'm just one person. What can I do anyway? There is nothing more powerful than one person.
Interesting you put it that way. I was reading some psychology not long ago about the fact that most people won't throw a rock through a window, but there are people who would do so after five other people did it or after two other people did it. But it goes in the other direction, too. You know, not most people wouldn't stand in front of a police officer's gun unless they saw three other people do it. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Let's take a call from Burrell in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rachel Kadish and Jessica Shattuck.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I just finished reading a book called Frauen, which is women in German. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember who the author was or when it was published. I think it was
Allison Owings. It's one of my favorite books. It's great.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I was going to say that's a fantastic. She interviewed all these women who had survived the Third Reich from different viewpoints. And it was very, very fascinating to read. So I just wanted to mention that book.
All right. Thanks so much for bringing that up. And what can you tell us about the book, Jessica?
Oh, that book is a wonderful book, and I actually have done some work with Allison Owings because I reached out to her in the process of writing this book because it was so instrumental to me. It's just amazing accounts of German women living through World War II, and they span the gamut, as the characters in my novel do, from resistors to literally unrepentant Nazis who she's interviewing in 1987 or something, who are still saying Hitler was right about this and that and whatever, to everyone in between. And she just, it's a wonderful oral history. I recommend it highly.
So as you two, I noticed you've done other interviews together and written some works together as well. And I wonder what the general response you're getting from people is. Rachel?
Yes. I'm sorry. I didn't quite hear what the question was.
It was sort of a broad and stupid question, but it's about the fact that you two have been obviously doing other interviews together, and I wonder what kinds of responses you're getting from groups that you talk to.
Oh, okay. Well, I think one of the main concerns that people raise when this subject comes up is, you know, are you here to talk about forgiveness? Are you here to talk about guilt? And I think that is a kind of makes everybody very stiff when we go into this conversation. But I think, you know, when Jessica and I start speaking, I think something that's important to clarify right away is that we're not here to talk about whether she should feel guilty or whether I forgive her because she didn't do anything and I'm not the person who could forgive. You know, it's not that conversation. What we're here to talk about is responsibility, what we do going forward. And I think that that's a conversation people really want to have. How do you move forward? As opposed to how do we lock ourselves into roles that don't improve the future?
Mm-hmm. Do subsequent generations carry the shame or the guilt of previous ones on any level, you think?
Oh, I think so very much. I mean, I Jessica, I don't know what you would say about this, but I think very much. I think there are things that we're not even aware of that go into our emotional upbringing, our emotional makeup, ways we react to things. You know, the fears that I think crop up sometimes just based on things, you know, I grew up with. I mean, I have a friend whose mother can't jump. She can't physically jump because she grew up in a DP camp, but there wasn't play, and she never learned the muscle skills to just get both feet off the ground at the same time. You know, when you grow up with things like that, it stays with you. And I know it's part of my emotional makeup. I mean, Jessica, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I would also add that to me, I think there's a somewhat political element of responsibility that I feel that I feel guilt and shame about German history as a half German. And I think I try to use those in a constructive way to take some kind of responsibility. And one thing that I can think of to do with that is to have a conversation like this and to talk about these complicated issues and hopefully get the conversation going among other people. I think that it is, I'm always wary of people, Germans of my generation, who say, I don't feel guilty. Why should I be made to feel guilty? I wasn't even alive. I wasn't even born at that time. Because I sort of feel like, well, maybe guilt is not quite the right word. Maybe responsibility is a better one. But I think it's important that we all own our own history and our family's histories and our cultural histories.
We have about a minute left. I want to ask each of you in turn, what was the most surprising thing you found in the extensive research you did for your books? Jessica?
A million surprising things, but a couple of things that fascinated me. 20 million refugees in Germany, a country of 80 million people at the end of World War II. That was summer 1945. That was fascinating to me. The last DP camps, displaced person camps in Germany, shut down in 1957.
Wow.
That was also when the last German prisoners of war came back from Russia, 1957. Those were just a sampling of fascinating things that I learned.
And Rachel Kadish, for you, some of the biggest surprises?
You know, I think when I was researching this Inquisition refugee community, the 17th century in Amsterdam, these are people who have fled Portugal, how strongly they sometimes reminded me of the Holocaust survivors I'd grown up with in terms of their fears and the things that led them to be so worried about how they could present themselves on the outside.
Wow, lots of great stuff in the conversation and lots of good stuff in the books. I really enjoyed reading the parts that I read of both of them. Jessica Shattuck is the author of The Women in the Castle, and Rachel Kadish is the author of The Weight of Ink. Thank you, The Weight of Ink. Thank you both so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, good to have
you.
Yeah,
thank you.